You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
As a startup founder, you're juggling multiple priorities, from the expected, like finding product market fit, to the unexpected, like customer requests for SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification.
But achieving compliance is time consuming, and time spent on it is time away from the needs of the business.
That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one solution for startups to become compliant quickly and build a security foundation with ease.
With a combination of automation, an extensive partner network, and a security marketplace, Vanta provides the necessary tools and expertise for startups to achieve compliance seamlessly, no matter how urgent the needs are and at every phase of growth.
Over 10,000 leading companies, including CipherStash, Handle, and Indebted, trust Vanta to automate compliance so they can focus on growing their business.
Startup customers get 10% off Vanta at dayone.fm/Vanta/first check, or just go to the link in the show notes.
Hey, Maxine, quick question. Do you like birds? And what about cyber? Do you struggle with that?
Birds, yes. Cyber, well, it's complicated. But lucky for us, that's where Galahr Cyber swoops in.
Galahr Cyber is perfect whether you're a founder looking for practical security advice or an investor needing solid risk management for your portcos.
So if you want to secure your business and join a flock that is unlike most security firms, head over to dayone.fm/Galahr for your free conversation with Cole, who can set you off in the right direction.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, I'm Cheryl.
I'm Maxine.
This is First Check, part of Day One, the network dedicated to founders, operators, and investors.
If you want to be a better early stage investor, this is the show for you.
So TLDR, if you don't want to suck at investing, listen up.
This is part of our like deep dive series where topics that come up throughout our conversations or some of the podcast guests that we have tend to raise issues that we feel like we want to dive a little bit deeper on between the two of us. And so this time, this episode, we are going to be talking about, Maxine, drumroll,
liquidity, IPOs, why we're hearing so much hand-wringing in the ecosystem, why everyone's talking about M&A. I just feel like there's a lot of buzz around what's happening in IPO markets, a lot of hand-wringing going on. I thought it'd be really interesting for us to dive in, nerd out, and demystify some topics for folks out there in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I feel like every conversation I've had, especially with VCs lately, I'm at VC dinners and everyone's like, what are you doing about liquidity? What liquidity are you doing? What are options for liquidity? How can we get better liquidity? I have gotten really good at saying that word.
Yeah, it just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Liquidity, liquidity, liquidity.
Liquidity, liquidity, liquidity. We could turn it into a song.
I'm a terrible singer. I don't think anyone needs my liquidity song in their life.
Now I kind of want your liquidity song in my life.
It will never grace the face of this world, ever. I will never, ever release that into the world.
Maxine, theme song for the podcast. Crazy idea, bad pitch, theme song for the podcast.
That is a terrible pitch. Actually, no, I'm totally for that. That's a great bad idea, because I'm going to build on that and say I shouldn't be singing in the theme song for the podcast. Our listenership would go immediately to zero because it would pain people's ears as they were listening to me sing. So let's not subject them to that.
Okay, open call to anyone who is listening. If you would like to sing the theme song for the First Check podcast, please reach out. Okay, back on topic.
So back on topic, we're talking about liquidity, right? And I thought it would be interesting here to kind of start from fundamentals a little bit. Why do IPOs matter so much? Why do we spend so much time thinking, pontificating, analyzing IPO markets in the venture ecosystem? To start there, I think is a kind of great grounding. So why don't we dive in?
Ooh, maybe it might be good to quickly define those things. I remember the first time I heard the word liquidity and I was like, cool. So water has to do with VC how? It's such an interesting word because I think it is quite industry specific. I'm not sure if it gets used in like even, I don't know, definitely not using it in my everyday life with my friends when we're going out for drinks. Although now sometimes I do because I'm a total nerd like that.
Yes, you are, but in a different, completely different context. Lots of discussion of liquids.
Yes, lots of liquid discussions, not quite the same. My understanding of liquidity is basically you invest your money, and when you get some or all of it or a lot more of it back, that is called a liquidity event.
That's exactly right. So liquidity is a term of jargon, which is essentially means the ability to have cash or cash-like assets. So assets that you can use immediately for paying things, investing in things, etc. It is used in banking. You will hear it. Actually, I think it came roaring into view during the GFC, the global financial crisis, because banks were then, their liquidity was scrutinized, i.e. the amount of cash that they were required to hold. And the reason that it matters is the money you are required to hold that's not invested is not performing, or you're not getting any money from it, right? You're not getting any interest from it. And so people want to be investing as much of the capital that they have as possible. But if they have what they call liquidity requirements, which essentially means they have requirements on how much cash they have to hold so they can meet payments immediately when they're due, influences how much return they can get. In venture, the reason that we reference liquidity, it's essentially the ability to get money back so that you can ideally reinvest it back into the venture ecosystem, or what they call rebalance. So if you have a portfolio of assets, right, venture and private equity being one of them, let's say private debt being another one, term deposits and then cash, just to make it really simple, or probably shares, term deposits and cash. Each of those, if you have the right managers managing them or you're individually managing them, should grow at some kind of standard rate. In venture, it's between 30 and 40%. So let's say you invest $100 in venture and it grows at 30 to 40%. And then you have $100 that you invest in private credit, and private credit grows at the moment kind of 15%. And then you have another $100 that you put in shares that on average grows between kind of 8 and 10%. And then you have term deposits, which historically grow on average between, say, 3 and 4%. And then you have cash, which historically grows at 0%. Obviously, right now, those numbers are different, but let's say that's the mix. You can imagine, you can do some kind of basic compound math, that after a 10-year period, if they all perform as planned, $100 you invested in venture is going to be worth a lot more than the $100 you've invested in cash, because the cash portion isn't growing. And so you're constantly rebalancing, which means you're taking money out of the high growth stuff and putting it in the lower growth stuff, so that you aren't overexposed to very risky assets.
I mean, you might be doing that. I certainly am not. Which may or may not be problematic for my long term.
Ideally.
Ideally. Oh, right. Yes, ideally. Got it. And then the other two things we brought up there was IPOs and M&A. For anyone who hasn't heard that term, M&A stands for mergers and acquisitions, which is basically you get liquidity because the company you invested in gets acquired by another one or merges with another one. And then that company might be public, or that company might have other options for you to get money back. And IPO is initial public offering, which is they go list on the ASX or the NASDAQ or the New York one, that big one. And then you can sell your shares.
Nailed it. Love those definitions. So essentially the IPO is when you take, you know, as an investor in the private markets, you are buying private shares. And the IPO is when you make those shares available to the public via an exchange, like the ones that Cheryl just mentioned. And so the IPO as an outcome is the ideal, or historically kind of on average has been touted as the ideal outcome for a venture scale business. Historically, actually, if you kind of go back to earlier cycles, at least in the US, you would see companies list on the stock exchange much earlier in their journeys than they currently are. And the reason that that is relevant, coming back to the definition of liquidity, is when they list on the stock exchange, that is the moment that their shareholders could then get money back on those investments.
100%. I think the phenomenon of companies staying private longer has become super relevant and is one of the biggest reasons that we are having these conversations now, because it's kind of 10 years on from, you know, when venture really took off in Australia, and that trend has only gotten bigger and only gotten stronger, in particular in Australia. Like, and I think even the market cap of companies list on the ASX, we haven't seen huge exits there. What I also think is interesting is that the vast majority of exits actually end up being M&A. and not like everybody thinks, oh, you know, like when the company IPOs, but I don't know the exact stat, but like the majority of exits and liquidity events come from mergers and acquisitions, not IPOs. We just happen to hear about the IPOs more, right?
Right. Because the IPOs are much bigger, right? Those are the like hallmarks. It's an interesting question. I don't actually know what the data is in terms of like quantum of returns, right? Dollars returned. Do you get more of it in M&A or do you get more of it in IPO? What I mean by that is because, so as Cheryl just mentioned, like the vast majority of the exits you will have in a portfolio, they happen by another company buying one of the companies in your portfolio. But usually, in fact, almost exclusively, those exits are not your big fund returners, right? They're not the places where you make the vast majority of your returns as a fund. You make the vast majority of your returns as a fund on the companies that kind of return, they get to that unicorn status. And so most of those companies, they're getting to that status by listing on a stock exchange, so doing an IPO, as opposed to a private M&A. But it's an interesting question. I don't actually know if, because let's say like in a portfolio of 30 companies, 20 of them will exit via, or probably 25 of them will exit via some version of M&A, even if it's like an acqui-hire for no dollars, all the way through to like maybe one or two will end up IPOing in theory. And, but the amount that you make from those one or two probably is more than the amount that you would make from the other 25 via M&A. Anyway, semantics. So I think the reason that this is relevant, right, is this is the way that investors get their money back. Historically has been the way that money, that investors get their money back. Increasingly, we're seeing creative solutions for early investors to get their money back because, as you mentioned, right, they're like holding these investments for a longer period of time. So I wonder if it's worthwhile here to kind of dive into why do we care about the health of the IPO markets and why does it matter for venture?
Yeah. I mean, why does it matter? Why do we care? It's one of those topics where like, I was a little nervous to be like, well, you know, we all know anecdotally that the health of the IPO market right now is not great globally and mergers are sluggish. And I was like, you want to talk about something that possibly is like a bit doomy and gloomy. And as an angel that is entirely overly optimistic, a glasses overflowing type optimist, that doesn't sound like a topic that I want to cover very much. But go for it, Maxine. Tell me, why should I care about this?
Yeah. So I think we should care about it because in its most fundamental, as an investor, you are buying future cash flows. So you are either buying future cash flows via dividends at some point in the future, or you are buying what you predict someone in the future will themselves predict about the future cash flows of that business, i.e. you are selling to another investor who is buying you out, who is they themselves buying the future cash flows of the business. And I think that's a really important thing to anchor in on. So leaving that definition there for a moment, the reason we care about the IPO market is in venture, you're almost never buying future cash flows in the form of dividends, right? You are buying what some future investor, you predict that future investor is going to think the value of the business is based on the revenue and cash profile of that business or potential revenue and cash profile of that business in the future. Historically, that has been your prediction at IPO. The ability for it to get to, you know, a unicorn status exit or your prediction on M&A. So another buyer will buy that company for a valuation range that makes that entry valuation you're coming in at worthwhile.
Risk-adjusted worthwhile, right?
Risk-adjusted. Yeah. You have to take into account the fact they're going to hold this bitch for like, you know, 10 to 15 years. And that, you know, there is an opportunity cost of that capital. So me investing money in a private company means that I can't invest it in, say, the public market and have access to it whenever I want. And so there is an illiquidity premium that I'm paying, or what is known as an illiquidity premium, meaning I can't access the money, so you have to pay me more to hold it, in layman's terms, or being paid a premium for the amount of risk that you're taking, right? Venture is a very risky asset class relative to, say, cash or private debt.
Bonds.
Bonds. Exactly. Like, that's why on average you should be returning, you know, something around 30% IRR net of fees as a fund manager. So that means in the private market, if for a second we imagine that the, in inverted commas, payday, i.e. IPO, at the end of this is taking two times as long, and 50% of the companies that we predicted would get there are actually getting there, that means that the fundamental assumptions based into these investments will have to change, right? You need to be paid more from a return profile perspective if you're now asking me to hold this share, an illiquid share, for 20 years, and the likelihood of you getting there is 50% of what I thought it was. So the risk goes up, the illiquidity premium goes up, and so the fundamentals of the investment should change. And so that's why you're seeing so much hand-wringing about IPO markets, because at the moment, because 2022 and 2023 were so astronomically crap in terms of funding markets, we're not seeing a lot of companies list in the US. So those investors are still holding that cash. And we are not seeing that same graduation rate because those companies, you know, have struggled to get to those key milestones to be able to list. And so that's why we care about it.
I love that. So devil's advocate here. In the ZIRP era, money was free. Everyone was growing. IPOs were fantastic. Mergers were off the charts. Back in, you know, 2020, 2021, everyone was investing like, you know, people were making investment decisions based on the current market. Now we're in this like sluggish era and we're saying we should make investment decisions based on this current market. Crazy idea. Shouldn't we be doing the opposite? Like, what if I invested right now as if by the time my investments come to fruition in 10 years' time and they want to exit, we're going to be back into some kind of ZIRP era. And back then, like, shouldn't we have all back in 2020 been investing as if when our investments would have come to fruition, like now to a couple of years from now, it's going to be a sluggish market? Like, shouldn't you just do the opposite of what's currently? And then, you know, you're just tapping right into that we've seen this, right? It's like 10 to 15 year time cycles. And so can't we predict that in 10 to 15 years, when the investments that I make right now are going to start to try to exit, it's going to be happy days again?
I mean, like, I think it is such a good question, right? Because like, we are not really set up, humans and our brains are not really set up to naturally think on that kind of time scale. So the best investors in the world, as I say, kind of get greedy when everyone else is scared and get scared when everyone else is greedy. So yeah, like applying that to that circumstance, like, no, you shouldn't have been buying everything on leverage in 2021. That probably was a bad strategy, right? Because you probably could have predicted that this dynamic couldn't have lasted forever, right? And the best investors, well, some of them made that prediction. But I think that is actually why early stage investing is so attractive to me right now. And I think, you know, is worthwhile considering, is because you are making a prediction about what the markets are going to look like in 10 to 15 years. And that, you know, probably the prediction you are making is that they are more liquid, that they will be more freed up. I also think that, like all entrepreneurial environments, great challenges offer great opportunities. And so I'm actually really excited that everyone is constantly talking about liquidity at the moment, because I think it's starting to put pressure on the opportunities for secondaries.
Yeah.
And we heard in our podcast previously with Christina from NewView talking about the opportunity in secondaries, the fact that in private equity markets, it is a 10x differential between how many secondaries are transacted in the private equity markets versus venture.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Nuts, right? 10x, an order of magnitude behind how much is transacted in the secondary market.
Like, what are we doing wrong over here? We need to take a page out of their book and start to apply it. Like, we absolutely need to be better at secondaries, I think globally, but also like Australia, man, could we go down from zero? Like,
yeah.
If it's sluggish now, like, we're basically at zero anyway.
Totally. So both secondaries and M&A, you know, we have one secondary fund, like one big established secondary fund, the folks at Second Quarter. And we have a couple of others that do like more opportunistic secondaries. I heard on the grapevine actually that Airtree did a secondary of their own position in Canberra in the last liquidity market and bought it into their opportunity fund.
Yeah, that's true.
Like they sold in their primary and bought in their secondary, which is, I think, a huge testament to Canva and very clever strategy. So I think that like the opportunity here is that we will start to see more products where people come in and they buy both primary secondaries, i.e. you're buying like secondaries in companies. But also, I think we're going to start to see people buying secondaries in funds. So you will see people buying fund positions in some of the earlier vintages for investors that are locked up.
Yeah, I think second quarter already do a little bit of that. I think we need more transparency around how secondaries are transacted, when they are done, and what that looks like. People could talk about them more and provide information around like what happens when a secondary sale happens. Like we actually don't know like what the details were about the Canva secondaries. We have no idea when other secondaries are happening. I feel like every secondary that I have kind of heard of happens behind closed doors. You know, a syndicate runs that, or maybe an early employee like hands it off to their friend, and we have no idea like what the valuations are. I don't think there's like a standard across the board of, you know, what is the standard of if you're buying secondaries from employees? Is it like a standard 20% discount? If we can get to a stage where there is more transparency and openness about this, we might start to see standardization and less of like behind closed doors stuff and people being able to be like open about it. Like I almost feel like secondaries are kind of a taboo subject at the moment, especially founder secondaries. Do you feel the same?
100%. Yeah. I think that's actually there's two probably threads to pull out there, right? Like founder secondaries, especially as part of a primary transaction, right? They became quite popular in the ZIRP era and they are extremely unpopular again. And I think that the fundamentals of them have remained the same. Like founders shouldn't be cashing out so much that they just want to be like on the beach. But I also think that there's an enormous amount of value giving some secondaries, right? Like modest secondaries once founders are getting to kind of series A, series B to take a little bit off the table.
100%, yeah. I've heard from investors who have declined that though.
It's maybe a topic for another podcast to talk about like the pros and cons of founder secondaries.
Yeah, founder secondaries.
Because I think there is a solid debate to be had there.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, maybe we should get the folks on set from Second Quarter or some of the other big secondaries funds to kind of talk.
Yeah, maybe we should.
But I do think on fund secondaries and on your point about opacity, right, it's currently, because it is a low volume market, it's a very inefficient market. So price discovery is really hard because it's really hard to find buyers and sellers on both sides. And so there's a couple of people in the US that are building like Forge and Equity Zen. I think Forge is a listed company that allow for a kind of more marketplace-y approach to the transaction of these secondaries. And famously, Carter has been trying to build a secondaries product on top of their product for a really long time now and have flubbed it 3 times, most famously when they started to try to sell secondaries out from underneath founders.
Yeah, I think we all heard about that in the news a few times.
Yeah. The gift of hindsight. But I think secondaries is an opportunity here is super exciting, right? To add some liquidity into these markets. I think the other thing to name here is why companies are staying private for longer. And whether that actually is a good or a bad thing. You know, when I think about why companies are staying private for longer, I think there is actually an opportunity and there's a role to play here from governments and also the regulators to make listing not as painful as it currently has become, right? If you look in the US, it's pretty hard to make the case that founders should list on a stock exchange. You know, when it has been as historically painful and the disclosure levels are so high.
Yeah. Like, hey, founders, would you like to have a whole lot more disclosure and reporting requirements and a lot more scrutiny and less control of your company and several other things that don't sound so great? You in? Yeah.
We're in. And you're not getting meaningfully more access to capital than you can currently get in private markets, right? I think that's a key bit. It used to be that the only way you could get access to that volume of capital is when you had to list. Now, I think something that's not talked about that much that is worth profiling here and for any founders that are listening to it, which is currently, and I know that you've been super vocal in this place, right? Currently, because all of this wealth creation is happening in the private markets, it is only really available to a small percentage of the Australian population. And by choosing to stay private, it continues to consolidate wealth in
the uppermost brackets.
Those groups, the sophisticated investor groups, or the people who can access via retail, but they have to kind of like, et cetera. Whereas once you list on a public stock exchange, then the kind of mom and pop shops via their financial advisors or direct investors can start to participate in this wealth creation. So I think that there is a really valuable discussion to be had with policymakers on why it's actually really valuable to bring down the barriers for entry to these public stock exchanges, especially for these kind of high growth startups, recognizing that they are very risky assets, right? And so making sure that there is the appropriate test.
But also a lot of the things on the stock exchange are already risky.
Totally. Some of those penny stocks are true junk.
Are all those like mining speculation stocks? You're like, you say that you don't want to invest in venture, but then you just told me like the six speculation mining stocks that you bought last night. I'm like, kind of similar risk profile there, but okay.
Yeah, kind of the same. One has cash flow, one is pure speculation.
Yeah.
I'm hoping we see a maturation of the discussion around when to list and how to list. I think in the Australian market, we have, what is it, like 200 to 300 mil enterprise value seems to be about the right time to list on the Australian market.
Yeah. We have actually, I think Australia has a pretty healthy small cap market because they've actually done a lot of that work to make it easier to list. Like there's a whole campaign a few years ago when I was running StartCon where their campaign was like, list on the ASX instead of your Series B. And it was fairly successful. I think the trouble is that the ASX doesn't have the largest market cap. So it's hard to, like, if you're going for that like $10 billion opportunity, for example, I think that's why Canva is looking to the list in the US instead of Australia. So if you're going for that like outsized $10 billion exit, then like the ASX isn't the place, but that doesn't mean that you can't use it as a stepping stone, and they have done a really great job in making it easier for small cap companies to list. That's why we see a lot of them.
Super interesting. And I think we also have quite a good investor pool that are interested in small cap tech stocks, right? Like it's quite an efficient, quite an active group.
Yeah, 100%. There's a number of small cap funds that focus just on small cap. So I think the investor pool is there and can only grow.
That's super exciting. Yeah, and I think it's a really good option for the founders that are listening, but also for the investors thinking about, you know, how might that kind of exit be a good exit for some of these companies that are maybe going after, especially while growth capital is so hard to come by at the moment. So the last thing I thought would be worthwhile talking about as well is there's been this kind of clampdown on M&A globally. Right? I think collectively the regulators around the world have learned that tech consolidates in a way that's maybe a little different or looks a little different at the outset than traditional companies. And so you're seeing this in the US at the moment with Linda Kahn being quite heavy-handed on the M&A policies. But our own Jim Chalmers actually has been proposing some reforms on M&A checks and balances that I think actually could be quite disadvantageous to the Australian tech ecosystem. Although you made the point before, like, we're already not getting a great M&A environment anyway for tech. And so can you go down from 0%? Probably not. You know, I don't see them starting to sell some of the assets that they bought.
But you can keep it at zero. So
no. I would like strongly prefer that they don't keep it at zero. They might. They could. They could keep it at zero. But
well, if they implement the changes, possibly, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly right. In your experience investing, have you seen many M&As with Australian acquirers or the vast majority of your acquirers overseas?
I would say actually a good chunk of my portfolio, I know I say good chunk, I mean, I've invested in 30 companies. I'd say two of them have merged with another Australian company, but these are small and it's like share for share kind of thing. I think the most recent one that we saw was Mr. Yum and Me and You, which is an Australian example that they went together. There's a few others, I think, that like I can name in my indirect portfolio. So like the companies and the funds that I've invested in, where I've seen Australian companies acquiring other Australian companies within the portfolio. So I could probably name at least a dozen off the top of my head The most recent one that I'm thinking of where there's like a large US acquirer was Instacluster, right? And that returned like 3x, I think, OIF's fund. So that was, I mean, that was one that is somewhat recent and overseas.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing I think is that the Australian ecosystem, as well as the EU ecosystem and the UK ecosystem, the big M&As still happen with the big US tech companies, right? And so the little M&A can happen locally, but we just don't have big enough tech companies in Australia to start buying really big acquisitions of Australian companies or others. So I think it continues to be kind of international. And what I think is interesting about this proposed rule, what Jim Chalmers is proposing, that the ACCC would be given powers to review acquisitions where there is the purchase of 20% of the stock of that company, or kind of effective oversight of that company, and one of the transactors have over 200 million in enterprise value. Sorry, 200 million. Yeah, 200 million in run rate. So in revenue.
That's a pretty low number.
It is a pretty low number, though.
Yeah.
Right. And if one of the transactors, I actually don't know in the proposal if that applies to international companies, but just the requirement that the company has to be submitted to the ACCC, or the deal has to be submitted to the ACCC for review, it's going to start putting kind of a big splash of cold water on the extremely nascent M&A market in the Australian ecosystem.
That's problematic.
It's problematic. It's problematic. And so I'm hoping that the Australian tech ecosystem starts to have a conversation about this, because if it does go through as part of the M&A proposals, it will put another dampener on liquidity in the ecosystem.
Which, and we're already at a depressed time, a sluggish time. So yeah, going down from that doesn't sound like a good idea. I'm curious, where are those changes up to? Like, are they happening? Can we fight it?
We absolutely can fight it, yeah. They were proposed in early October, about a couple of weeks ago, by Jim Chalmers. And so I believe they are open for engagement from the public. So we should engage as the tech ecosystem, because it's going to have a pretty significant effect.
Shoddy not. Someone else can take it on this one.
Shoddy not.
Yeah. I already did the wholesale investor changes.
You definitely took one for the team.
Yeah, I already took one for the team. Someone else was up to bat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd actually love to see the tech council line up for this one, because this matters for big tech as well as for little tech, because an enormous amount of growth for big tech is actually driven by the acquisition of smaller tech companies.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Google, Microsoft in the back, if you wouldn't mind stepping up to the plate, that would be great.
Yeah. TCA, push them.
Yeah, exactly. So that is a little rundown on where we're at in terms of liquidity in the ecosystem and how we're seeing capital move around. For the folks in the back, or anyone that's looking to build something interesting, I would strongly encourage you to think about how to solve liquidity and earlier liquidity for LPs. If you come up with any brilliant ideas, you know, please hit me up.
And angels.
And angels. Yeah.
100%. We back you. If you do, feel free to reach out. Or if you have any ideas about something, please feel free to reach out, and we'd love to brainstorm with you.
We'd love it.
Thanks, Maxine. Great session.
Thanks.
I'm Lucy.
I'm Carrie, and welcome to Mumbition, the podcast. We chat with incredible women sharing the hilarious, messy, and brilliant truth about mixing motherhood and chasing dreams.
Because building a business while building Lego empires, not always easy, but definitely possible.
So grab a coffee, probably reheated, tune in, and join our community of women who get it.
Mumbition, the podcast for mums daring enough to do both. Unapologetically.
Available now wherever you squeeze podcasts into your day.